Hey, this is Mike Klassen. Thank you for tuning in to Vancouver Overcast, a new podcast where we have conversations with city leaders and innovators. In this first episode, I've invited two well-known figures from Vancouver politics, former City Councillor George Affleck and Rob McDowell, a former independent and NPA council candidate. Both of them are some of the brightest minds on civic affairs and local politics, and I'm very pleased that they allowed themselves to be my so-called podcast guinea pigs as we tried out new studio equipment. This first podcast has a couple of patches where the audio levels are not perfect, but we're working those out for future episodes. And now, it's time for Vancouver Overcast.
Okay. We're live.
Okay, so we've kind of figured out some of the technology challenges here. So George Affleck, Rob McDowell, Mike Klassen here, and you guys are my podcast guinea pigs.
Yes, and to clarify, Mike, we're not in your basement, which is nice.
Yeah, no,
we're actually in your den. I don't know what this is.
It's
this
fantastic.
Is like a total man,
it's like a man cave.
Very cool.
This is
very jealous.
This is the Thinking Cap studio.
Fantastic.
I know we only have a little bit of time here, so let's just sort of throw some stuff around here. There's some interesting stuff, and I had three subjects I thought we might weigh into a little bit. This week I wrote about what I consider to be right now the political invincibility of the mayor. I want to maybe kind of dive into that a little bit.
Not if I have a say in any of that.
Okay. Second of all, I thought we might talk a little bit about the new development that is coming up the south end of Broad Bridge. I think it's really interesting how that's going to play out a little bit, and it's very early days, but I'd love to know what you guys think from what you've seen and some of the major changes that are coming, and obviously the profound politics behind it as well.
Yep.
And then finally, I noticed that the cover story, and I haven't read the feature piece yet about Oppenheimer and Park, but that has been obviously a bit of a quagmire, but I want to really talk about what potentially would be the sort of the way forward for that in a realistic way, because we've seen different parts of council and park board try to deal with it in different ways, and the mayor as well, and it doesn't seem to be moving forward. So
right.
So maybe why don't we start with, you know what, there was actually a fourth topic I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about the Webster Warps.
Oh yeah, I was at that. I was there, yeah. It's funny.
Yeah, because you and your company are behind the Mon Murray's, which is another really great event that I enjoy going to. I didn't attend the Jack Webster Awards this year. Probably the first time in years that I haven't attended, but I was quite pleased with some of the people who won this year. Frances Beulah for doing some of her reporting on election finance and municipal government, which is a subject near and dear to our hearts, I think.
Yep. More digging to be done on that one, I think.
First of all, let's talk about Kennedy Stewart. 1 year in office, he got a lot of press. Dan Fumano did some good writing, Mike Howell and others. I have seen this movie so many times before, and with incumbency having so much power and the ability to really, you know, kind of hold people in office for a long time, probably longer than they ought to. And then, obviously, the tweets with the prime minister, again, sort of reinforcing that narrative that that Kennedy keeps putting forward, that people take his calls. So what I put out there is I think that if he's able to hold the Liberals in this town, or a significant number of them, he's basically going to be able to, you know, govern the city as long as he wants. So with that in mind, I'm looking for people to challenge me on that notion, because I know that that elections matter a lot, and something, you know, could change.
Well, I think we talked about it before. The magic mix, the magic piece of this in Vancouver is the mushy middle, which is the federal Liberals, and who controls them controls the city. And Robertson and the Vision Machine were very effective at doing that. Mm-hmm. So you're right. If he can capture them effectively, and he can hang on to them. But that's the question. There's no true machine behind him aside from labor.
I think that there is incumbency is always a good thing for anybody, but you have to look at the results. I think more important for him in the victory that he might have in the next election will be who's running against him, and whether there's a third person like a Shauna Sylvester again who runs again, and that's who ate away at not only his vote but also the NPA's, and how many of those votes went each way. And I would say it's almost 50-50. 50 went to Shawnee, the other 50 went to Kennedy, And so to me, that's a wash. And then, of course, there was 5 billion parties on the right side of the spectrum, which affected the NPA. And if those parties can coalesce, and it looks like from what I hear from the AGM coming up, that it might be, they might be coalescing a lot of those people coming back to the NPA, that you'll have a stronger NPA as far as not having another party. So if there can be one party on the center to right of center in Vancouver, and a person like Sean O'Sylvester runs again, then Kennedy Stewart will lose. That's my opinion.
I mean, that's possible. I mean, and Shauna, I quite like her. I know that you do as well. We've had a chance to talk to her, and she's got a real passion for local government. I think she would be a great sort of person to have in the public sphere. But the likelihood of that sort of third wheel, I mean, we've seen it. You divide that left and you create some appealing candidate. I think it will maybe runs a little bit deeper than just having somebody who might not want to support Kennedy Stewart. I do think that we've seen this kind of core group that think that the city needs some more conservative values applied to it. And I see that, and I wonder if they are wrong in that idea. And I'm going to just put forward the idea that look at the MPA caucus that are in right now, ostensibly representing the center-right of politics. They've all...
Some of them, I think, center-left.
Yeah, so they've all become very sort of liberal center-left almost to a person in their approach to things.
Right.
Perhaps the one exception might be the unanimous passing of the Auditor General office.
And when once you're in power, you'll decide that that was a really terrible idea. Because an Auditor General just will slow everything down even further. Although I understand, and I was certainly somebody who supported the concept because of my frustration when I was there with Vision and the lack of transparency and the lack of concern about where the money was going. We've gone from $800 million to $1.3 billion in the last 10 years. Where is that money going? What are we getting for those services and that fund, those funds? So the Auditor General hopefully will unearth some of the information on that. But I think in the end, it'll slow government down. And I think that's a bigger concern. I think that, you know, looking... you know, we've talked about this, Mike, you know, and Rob, we talk about the mushy middle in Vancouver, right? You win with a mushy middle. So to me, when you talk about the financial and the right of center thinking, I think fiscally for sure, I look at Vancouver as a Paul Martin kind of liberal Vancouver, as a we're sort of floating in the middle, but we want fiscal prudency, but we want all the other stuff too, the social services, the environmental stuff, but we also don't want to spend too much money. You have this mixture. So if you can have a government that can provide the things that people care about. And I think back to Philip Owen, he was doing the four pillar stuff, but he was also fiscally prudent. And I think that's the kind of mayor people really want in Vancouver and the kind of council people want. But you know.
Yeah, but you can't deny that millennials vote very differently and they're motivated very differently. They collect their news and information differently. I mean, this so-called woke vote, you know, with that certainly Jagmeet got in the federal election, but I think Gregor Robertson had, and Trudeau got it 4 years ago, but being a woke vote, it switched right away and it turns on people. And I think in many ways, Kennedy Stewart has that woke, got that woke vote a year ago, and I don't know if he's going to get it again because it's fickle. It's a fickle master, and I think millennials, as much as we can understand them, their way they gather information and make decisions is quite unusual.
And I think that I know that one of our lists is Oppenheimer, and maybe I can transition to Oppenheimer because I think that Oppenheimer is going to play a big part in the next election. And I think a lot of millennials, the woke generation, are not happy with what's going on down there. I think I look at my kids, I look at people in their 20s, and they're seeing what's going on there and going, no, I don't think so. So there's this interesting generational thing where they're about the environment, but I think they also want, you know, good government and clarity, and they're not against some sort of action when necessary, and they don't, you know, I find sometimes younger people are more conservative than I was in my 20s.
You're right. And they're driven by, they're emotionally driven by imagery, right? More than perhaps we were. Mm-hmm. That's how they get their news.
I think the
imagery around Downtown Eastside and certainly around Oppenheimer as a sort of a nexus as to the Downtown Eastside of everything that's wrong with the Downtown Eastside or is concerning about it is really powerful. And it can be really used effectively by whoever captures that narrative and can use it, can harness it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm pivoting a little bit off your mushy moodle comment, George, because I mean, I think you're right, but I feel like politics in Vancouver is predictable as it once was. It really has gone a little bit through a bit of a tectonic shift in the last little while. And, you know, we're looking at, again, the millennial voters who, when they sort of come forward in significant numbers, can make a real difference in terms of, you know, who's going to lead the city. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen anybody who's really activated that vote. There was, I mean, you were on that independent slate, so-called, with
Sarah Blythe and
Sarah Blythe and Adrian Crook.
Probably can tap into that vein, I think, probably effectively, Adrian.
Yeah.
And he, I think he did, and Sarah Blythe did.
And you try to peg both Sarah and Adrian as examples of like, okay, they speak to this woke generation, but then you look at, you know, you think Sarah Blythe, and here she was campaigning for, what's his face up running up in Kamloops?
Terry Lake.
You think, what? Sarah Blythe is supporting Terry Lake, and he, you know, because of his marijuana stance, I guess. I'm not sure, and a bunch of other things. And I think he wanted, you know, drug policies. But, you know, here's a person that you would never expect to be supporting, a former BC Liberal, going, and you're like, this, there is no continuity, and that's not a bad thing. It's not an insult. There is no continuity to people like Adrian Crook and Sarah Blythe. They are their own personalities.
Yeah, right.
And I know that Adrian has, you know, he's a friend, and we have big debates about stuff, especially on the housing file. Sometimes his information is incorrect about City Hall, but he has his beliefs, and they are, you know, they're interesting. And it's, you know, like in politics, especially if you're really into politics, but there's a lot of people who are kind of half into it, and they come up to you and you'll say things and you're like, well, that's not even close to accurate, what your theory is. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to try to explain it to them, but they're not willing to budge from their theory.
That's right. But that also comes down to the big, I think, the biggest political divide in this city, which is the pragmatists versus the dogmatists. And you get that in every single party across, from the MPA, certainly, to COPE, and even in Vision. I mean, it's
kind
the reason.
What makes you an activist.
Vision,
you've got to be
Vision
dogmatic to be an activist,
you've
I think.
You've got to be dogmatic and faith-driven, right, mm-hmm. by whatever you're doing. But then when you get in, you have to figure out how the pragmatic power sharing works, how compromise works. So that
although
you can
we have the
done.
World's most pragmatic council in the history of Earth now, because it's all they do is talk.
Dogmatic.
All right. So
dogmatic and pragmatic, because they all think they're like trying to work this through.
Yeah.
So I'm going to bring up a political institution from which we all have close ties. 1938, I think it was in maybe a smoky room, maybe a few months before that.
Everybody was talking like this, see?
they formed a this so-called political machine that was really at the time trying to stop the socialist hordes. I mean, it was the 1930s after all. And it's gone through its various iterations and contortions and steps forward and two steps back along the way. I feel like for politics to be less predictable, something big has to happen. And I think the organization that has been here the longest is the one that is going to need some kind of transformation. And I'm not sure what that is yet. It used to be, as you know, a very lean and mean operation. It was run by a couple of people, and it got that council elected many times in a row. And then since then, we've had some successes. And of course, George, you were reelected a few times, but power always evaded the grasp. And it seemed like the MPA itself was not focusing on where the voters were, focusing on what people were wanting.
I think there's a disconnect or a connect that's a problem with the board and the caucus and then the electoral team that those three things are completely separate to me. In the MPA, there's a real problem that the board doesn't understand this. The board's role is meant to be keep administrating things, raise money, you know, plan for the next election. That's the MPA's basic mandate. It's not a political party, even though they changed their constitution to change the word association to party about 6 years ago. It still operates, and it's really challenging to find people who want to get involved in civic politics behind the scenes for 4 years. Most of them are just want to be politicians. So you have a party where you have a board who want to get involved in policy. You have elected who are there going, please don't get involved in our policies and our how we administer government. So those two are kind of fighting all the time and not connecting the way they should. And then frankly, they shouldn't connect. And then when the election comes, there's the third engine, which is the electoral team, like the team that who you bring as the, and generally should be the mayoral candidate who brings a solid team to win the election. And that has proven to be elusive in the last several elections. Partly because the first part was dysfunctional with the board. Second, the caucus was, actually has been in my time there, very, very tight. I don't know what it's like now, but clearly watching council, that council caucus is not united in any way that I can see. I worry that this, unless Mark Angus, who's the chair now of the board, and there's an AGM coming up, can get them off this whole, we want to be part of the process and about governance. That's not the only governance the board of NPA should be doing is the governance of the NPA. Get away from the people who are elected. If you hate them and don't like them, then don't vote for them or whatever. Run yourself. I don't know. It's really inappropriate that this board wants to get so involved in policy. And that's what is the dysfunction of the NPA. And then by the time the election comes, they're just not ready because they've spent all their energy and money on shit they're not supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. And infighting. I would add that there's sort of a propensity to bring someone, some magic outsider in that will solve everything. Yeah. And we've seen that twice. repeated that they don't understand that dynamic that you've just described.
And they come in and
they don't understand how to motivate or how to work with these various sort of entities. And
simultaneously alienated the elected people they have. That's been my experience.
Right.
Alienated the people, your incumbents. It makes no sense. Why are you doing that? They're winners. Stop alienating.
But they just think that's the magic bullet, right? It's like, we'll bring this person in.
They'll do everything.
They've never been to a council meeting before, but
you know what they're running for.
Vision governed for 10 years because it was able to hold together. It was a very disciplined caucus, and they were able to bring in both sort of green, NDP, and I guess you could say they were very good at embracing several key liberals in the city as well.
Liberals, yes.
And as that started to come unwound in the dying days of Vision leading up to the 2018 election, that's where there was an opportunity. There was an opportunity always to try and recoalesce voters that would be sort of center right. I mean, really, the thing is that we've probably spent too much time trying to impose big C conservative politics in Vancouver that doesn't really work right now. I mean, there are, and I think that if you are going to try and bring fiscal discipline to local government, then you have to be very selective, very strategic about how you're going to do that. But the fact is that right now, Kennedy Stewart, the team around him have figured out that the best thing that they can do right now is to cozy up to Ottawa and cozy up to Victoria. And that's their way of maybe kind of.
Yeah, but have they done that? I mean, I know that they spent. Well, we were already doing that.
The Broadway line to UBC, that was already happening. So well, good job, Kennedy. You did it.
So let's change gears and talk about the announced project that's going to be happening at the south end of the Broad Bridge. As we know, it's a complicated piece of property. It has deep historical roots to the First Nations.
To the Squamish. To be clear, it's Squamish. It's not Musqueam at all.
Yeah.
So that's just Squamish territory.
Yeah. So what do you think, and I was reading a tweet from Frances Beulah.
I saw that too, yeah.
Yeah, she said that people would be disappointed if this became mostly market housing, I think.
Why would Ian Gillespie get involved if he's not going to make some money here? I mean, obviously there's going to be expensive condos in there, or expensive rental units, and expensive retail, and mixture of office space. I mean, it's going to be a mixed community, but Squamish Nation have made a commitment to rental. We don't know exactly what we know the number, but we don't know the amounts, and whether or not they'll be specific to the people of the Squamish Nation. There's lots of unknowns. There are people who are arguing that it's too high, and I'm going, I don't understand that argument at all, given the neighborhood and where it's reflected across the water in Yale Town, where you have, 52-story towers, 56, 58, 62. I mean, I live in a building that's got 30 floors. Next door is a building that's got 42 floors. Another building that's got 50 floors. And I can't tell the difference looking up which one's got 30 or 50.
Yeah.
Once you go past, 12, it's...
And think of the building that's been there since, I think, about 1970,
yeah.
Which was, I think, was it owned by Mayor Tom Campbell? I think there's a connection with Mayor Tom Campbell, really? Who was the
yeah. I thought that was a Squamish Nation construction. I didn't know that.
Really. Yeah, so okay. I may stand to be corrected, but I think there's a connection. And of course, it was during that NPA council before Team took power in 1972 that you would see some towers. Like for example, there's a couple of towers that you see. Like on, I think it's U and 3rd or something like that. You've got got some small towers that were kind of dotted.
I mean, from Yaletown, we don't really call those towers, but okay.
Well, they're not. Sure. But yeah, but they were high-rise buildings in a place that has almost none of them now.
You know, the difference between towers built in the 60s and 70s and towers built now is that there was no plan. The West End has no plan, in a way that we have this obsession with planning and planning and planning and planning and planning and talking and planning and planning and planning, and nothing ever gets built. You look at neighborhoods like the West End where it just happened. It was organic and the stuff just started coming up. There was a kind of a rough concept. There wasn't the kind of the community process in those days. And I think that's where you see the rest of the city having that challenge. However, back to the Squamish Nation, they don't have to do that. They go, this is our plan, enjoy. And so it's way easier for them to get stuff built. It's way cheaper for them to get stuff built. They don't have to go through any of the same processes. The one thing they have to do, though, is negotiate with the city on services, and that's going to be expensive for the people who live there. And
it'll be an interesting negotiation if we
We've had interesting
ones already. One thing I wanted to point out, though, I'm sure you guys were aware, and 10 years ago, remember that little sign that went up beside the bridge? How much controversy much pushback did we hear about that? That was a little sign, and even look at it now.
The digital sign, small, it went up the year that I ran.
And it was so controversial. Yeah, so sorry, but how is this going to work when there's going to be 11 towers that are going to be much bigger than those signs? It's like, ooh, that Kids Point neighborhood is going
to... So,
let's see.
I haven't delved into the details. I've just seen some of the schematics, and people sort of say, it's going to be a more of a car-free neighborhood, but you've got 6,000 residents there that A, need to get to work, most of them, and the other bunch of them are going to have to move equipment and furniture, and you're not going to decouple yourself entirely from the automobile in that area. So I'm just trying to think, especially the city has spent millions doing all that work at the south end of the Broad Bridge to try and make it, to modernize the transportation and the active transportation too, with all the work that they've done on the railings and the pedestrian and bike routes and so on.
Yes, and the Falls Creek streetcar plan that still exists, which extends out to the Broad Bridge.
Right, and the bike
bridge. That will be able to tie into any of those things.
I think the walking thing, and I mean, you look at Olympic Village, which is very challenging for cars to drive around, and it's as close as we have to a planned community that doesn't really care about cars. It really is challenging to drive there. And so they're looking at even further constraints, and I don't have a problem with that. I mean, as long as you know what it is when you're getting in there. I look at my building, and I would say half the spots in the building that I live in are empty.
And a reminder, this is a guinea pig session, and George and Rob have decided to come in 100%. Here and allow me here to test out some gear. You were talking about Olympic Village. You're right, it has become kind of a great model. And
but even South Falls Creek, when that was built, like that design community, right,
from
the
70s,
it's not a real car-dependent... I mean, certainly I'd like to see more density there, but it was never designed, even in the 70s, as a car-dependent neighborhood. Right?
So one of the things that maybe I haven't let go of it, I know others bring it up to me occasionally, and there are enthusiasts for that streetcar line. And it's actually, it's not really a streetcar because it is on a rail right-of-way. But I'm thinking that with the Olympic Village and potentially some of the Arbutus, I'm thinking that with the investment going into that area, transportation is going to be pretty key. Having an actual right-of-way, a line that goes through
automated vehicles, though. I wouldn't want to see track laid.
Entered the era of post sort of streetcar tracks, right? But still sort of a virtual system that would be driverless
along a route that
the bus that would go along a road, a dedicated
We've already had had a sample drive around Olympic Village fairly successfully. So, I think their right-of-ways are important, and it's not just for car drivers. It's for bicycles, for trains, for everything. It speeds things up, and that's why not owning a car in that neighborhood would be fine, because that track could go very close to that neighborhood, run right by it, but close enough. And, the Burrard station, well, there'll be an Arbutus station, and there'll be a Granville station on the Broadway line. So you're like 6-8 blocks from that That's not very far. It's a hill, but right. I'd imagine there'll be more buses going up Broadway.
We haven't even started really here, Vancouver, dealing with electric bikes, and I think e-bikes are going to be a huge thing. We're seeing what they're doing down in California. That's a whole generation of people that are going to be accessing bikes and using them and going pretty fast.
You see them more in North Van, actually. It's surprising to see how many e-bikes you see because of the hills in North Van. I see a lot more people in North Van riding e-bikes.
Right.
Oppenheimer Park.
Yeah.
I recognize that it is very complex and it's very sad what's been going on there, and it's been going on for too long, and we're going into the winter months, so it becomes, even if you did think there was any romance to being outside and sleeping outside, it's going to get a lot worse. And what's interesting to me is how we've come into this kind of gridlock that seems to be very political to me. We've got the police telling us it's a dangerous place and they want it dealt with. And then you get so much pushback. And I've known Stuart MacKinnon for a long time. You know, I know Stuart digs his heels in on a few issues. But this one surprised me. And I'm surprised that this has fallen down so much down political lines. And I know that it's to the credit to, you know, people like Lisa Dominato and Sarah Kirby-Young, who I think were courting their Green colleagues on council, and they were trying to come up with something that might work, that that they could
get. One of them that's on council supported it last time we did an injunction, so you'd think he would be supportive of that. He's Green Party.
And then, of course, over on the park board side, you know, I get the sense that John Cooper is getting frustrated with how things are going over there. And again, it's, you know,
and Trisha Barker, too.
And Trisha,
who was homeless, as she's talked about, being homeless, and how she is not, she's empathetic to the challenge of the homeless. And here she is, but this is not the way we do it. This is not a solution to the homeless problem, to let people put tents in our parks. And I think there's this definite wedge kind of issue, much like putting golf courses into whatever the hell is going on with that one. it's a lightning rod of an issue, but it's the indecisiveness that's frustrating about this. When I was on council with Vision, who dominated, at least we were decisive, and they had controlled park board at that time when we had this problem, and we were very strategic and got rid of through injunction at Oppenheimer Park, and because we knew this was not the way to solve the problem. This was a problem. A lot of the people down there are protesters. They're not really, and some of them aren't even homeless. So it's really frustrating that it's become this tool, really, for people to speak their truth.
And I would have two things to add to that. One is, I think it exposes the leadership vacuum in the Greens, and that's school board as well. Let's face it, they all have the similar challenges. They're going around in circles with a lot of the issues at school board, and the Greens are everything to everybody, and this is showing that maybe that doesn't work because they're afraid. They're populist by nature, and they're afraid to make actual decisions that we need to make to show leadership, and that's really what we're seeing here. The other thing is I worry that with all the advocates, with the police, with everyone else so focused on the Oppenheimer Park, that what we're really not hearing from are the people that live there in that neighborhood. Yeah. And we're not hearing from them. We're hearing from the campers and the people that are in this space and other advocates from outside, but we're not hearing from the actual neighborhood, and their voice is lost. And I think that's a real tragedy here.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought that up, Rob, because I was wondering who are the leaders? I mean, they have a lot of people who'd like to speak for them, but I'm talking about the people who can articulate why it is that they need to be there. And it seems to me that person is missing from this political bun toss that's been going on over between the different political parties.
Right.
Well, the mayor has been clear in his opinion about this, but he also knows there's not much he can do. But I think there's more he can do. I think that there's a tool where they can fire the park board through the province, so they can if that's going to happen if somebody dies, that would show negligence on the park board's point, and they would need to be removed. At that point, the province would have to move in and remove them, much like happens with school boards. Because I think that there's also a way the police can be much more specific in their strategy in this, and I think that they need to find a way to be stronger on this. They are being strong in complaining about it, but I think there are tools that through the legal system that they can use that I think they need to use to solve this problem. They're worried about riots, though, and that's understandable. But we've done it two times where we've managed to get people out of there through the process. We're looking for this injunction, but I think there are other tools, the toolbox that the police or the province could be more involved in, but I don't think, certainly the province is not interested in getting involved in this.
So we don't have much time of your time left, so I'm going to shift gears. Just going to talk a little bit about the Webster.
My 11-year-old Wars. Producer who's yelling across the room here is giving us the booth. Signal here.
He's giving us time.
The Webster Awards happen. You obviously are a part of the Mom Murray Awards. Do we need to keep doing these kinds of award ceremonies? I'm just throwing it out there. I'm not trying to. I enjoy going to them, and I enjoy, you know, witnessing all the joy that comes from the floor in those kinds of things. But for a time, I found that the narrative was one of, shall I say, there was a bit of self-pity, right? We're going through all these changes and all this stuff.
Right.
And then I wasn't at the 2019 awards, but at least I didn't hear from anybody that I was following that night that there was a lot of introspection and kind of and sort of complaining about,
Know. I mean, I look at, the awards event that my agency manages is much more structured, and it's very, I have a very clear system that we have, and we follow a very detailed clock, but the booze is all free. But unlike the Jack Webster's, where it's kind of chaos, but you have to pay for your booze. So, but I think that both of them and any awards event, especially in industries who are being attacked in multiple directions these days sometimes by politicians, in a lot of cases, especially the print media and TV and radio have been obviously going through very, very troubling times with the change, the evolution of journalism. So celebrating what you do and patting yourself on the back is sometimes the only thing that keeps you going.
No kidding.
And right. So I really think that it's and as was said by many speakers that night this year, it's really democracy relies on journalism. I was a trained journalist. I kind of dabbling in it again now. And as an ex-politician, I 100% respect the work that journalists do. Sure, it could be scary when you're a politician, when certain journalists call you. But you know what? If you don't have answers and you are doing something shifty, you deserve that to
get
that
call.
And it
should be scary. Sorry, it should be scary when you're a politician. Yeah. You should be afraid. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You should never be complacent about what you're doing. And you should never think that you have the answers to everything, right?
You need that estate. You need that industry to keep us honest.
I'm going to... because we're getting the producer, signal. I'm going to wrap things up. I'm going to thank you very much for allowing me to at least try and kick the tires on a new system and some new gear and see what things work and what didn't. I'm looking forward for us doing a bit more of this. So thanks very much to George Affleck, Rob McTell, and Mike Klassen.
Thank you.
And we'll see where this goes. Thanks very much.
Cheers.